work with Marcus on something fun. But there's other stuff that I do. And I want to clarify that statement, is that there are times when you do things that you need to do to accomplish some greater goal. And there will be times, this is particularly directed to the graduate students, when you will find this is onerous. And every once in a while, you have to look back and figure out, you have to redefine what you call fun. Because physics isn't always going to be fun. If you define it by the old standards. So this is something that's fun because it helps us to make some progress, I think, in our understanding of collider data.
But normally you wouldn't have called it fun, is that the point?
When I was younger, I would have thought it was fun.
Now you're imposing it on us.
That's right.
Character building.
So I'll be talking about modified leading order partial distribution functions. In particular, they have to be modified to be used for event generators. And I'll try to talk about all this terminology. This is work in progress with my CTEC colleagues, in particular Joey Houston, and Pavel Nadolsky, John Pumplin, Dan Stump, Wookie Tong, and CPY, which is just a subset of CTEC. For those of you who don't know, CTEC is a collaboration of, actually CTEC stands for a collaboration of theorists and experimentalists to investigate quantum QCD, quantum chromodynamics. So it's a nice mix of people who have different types of expertise. And they have been primarily known for doing PDF fitting. And they've sort of expanded their scope a bit. And now the PDFs are becoming more important in terms of event generators. That's why it's natural for me to have joined them.
Oh, okay.
Have we already booked you for MC for BSM?
What's that?
Do you already have a save the date for April 1st.
I'm on the organized security, so I got all
the
announcements.
Okay.
So first, this I didn't expect this would be in the LHC conference time, but this is a good talk for that. This is just a cartoon with some points on it, and these points will come up again and again, and if you have any questions on what they mean, if I don't describe them well enough or explain them well enough, you should ask me to clarify some issues. This is sort of a cartoon, a Rick Field cartoon, of what a hadronic collision would look like. Here you have, this is particular for the LHC, you have protons coming in the middle you have something which is like a fireball or a flash, and out of it comes, you have incoming some partons and outgoing some partons. And in terms of Lagrangian, the standard model of Lagrangian, that's sort of what we're always thinking about. But there are these other features that occur which are either predicted by QCD or consequences of QCD, which take that picture and blur it. So for example, the partons you thought were coming in will have additional partons added in from a mechanism called initial state radiation, or that's just the term that we use for it, that's the way we model it. Nature is nature, but we try to break it down into little bits. So one of the bits that we call is initial state radiation. Some of these partons will develop structure as they go out, that's called final state radiation. There's also the fact that you've taken the proton and you've done a great injustice to it by pulling out some hard partons, and there's this stuff left over, and on our time scales, that stuff has to get back together and become color singlets. So there was a violent collision that took place. Something has to rearrange to turn things back into a color singlet. In that process, you will get a lot of tracked activity, a lot of maybe semi-hard QCD activity, and we classify that as the underlying event, because when you look at data, what you'll see is the event you're interested in, and then underlying that event, you'll see a bunch of activity that you try to understand and you need to understand. So to get an understanding of this, and you need to understand this, this could be some funny Z prime going to two jets, or this could just be a QCD process. Okay, we're interested in getting to the Z prime, for example, but or the technero or whatever it is, but we need to understand all this other stuff to be able to say anything either qualitative or quantitative about what's happening. So some of the topics that you have to do research in to get a global picture of this is you need to understand leading order, next leading order, and n to the m order calculations. And what comes out of that are things that we tend to call k-factors. I'll discuss that a little bit. Part of the phenomenology here is something called parton distribution functions, or PDFs. And now we have PDFs with uncertainties. I'll discuss that a little bit. I already talked about this phenomenon called the underlying event and things called, do you have a stick pointer?
You do, somewhere.
When I was here, there used to be a stick pointer.
Yeah,
I see
it,
right. Good. With respect to these PDFs and the uncertainties, there are some benchmark cross-sections. There are some cross-sections at the LAC that we're going to want to measure very well, which are standard model and boring. But they really help us to calibrate what's going on. And in particular, there are some correlations between those cross-sections that help us to fit the PDFs so that we have a better understanding of what are the incoming partonic luminosities so that we can predict event rates. Part of this phenomenon of initial state or final state radiation requires us to understand things called Surikov form factors, which basically tell you how this parton produced at a very large momentum transfer, how it develops shape and structure as it evolves to lower and lower scales where you eventually measure it. And then, of course, you need to understand jet algorithms and jet reconstruction. I won't talk about this at all, but it's an important topic related to phenomena like this. Okay. So during my career, our description and attack on parton distribution functions has undergone a revolution. It used to be that there were just various groups, and those various groups would fit a single parton distribution function, and you had basically three choices, depending on how many groups were out there, and the number of groups was small because this isn't a very profitable thing to do career-wise. It's much more sexy to be in the New York Times talking about string theory and how we're going to see that. So the parton distribution functions, which tell us inside the proton or inside the neutron or inside the antiproton, what is the luminosity of partons at a particular momentum fraction and a particular energy scale, these are important phenomenological inputs to many of our calculations. They set event rates, meaning if you can predict a cross-section and you know the luminosity delivered by your accelerator, you can put them together and figure out how many events of a certain type you should have seen. And it also affects the kinematics. For example, if you produce at leading order just a gauge boson, such as a Z, the rapidity of that gauge boson is directly related to the partonic Xs. Let me illustrate for you why that is. This is a very simple calculation, so I can do it in order. The rapidity, not the pseudo rapidity, but the rapidity is 1/2 the log of the energy plus the, this is basically the plus light cone momentum fraction, or not light cone momentum fraction, but the plus component of the light cone momentum and the minus component of the light cone momentum. Okay, where the beams are coming in along the Z axis. And of course, if you only have two, so this is a simple process, like Q cubed r equals to Z. This guy comes in with energy equals to X1 times the collider energy over 2. It comes in with Pz, X1. These are massless partons coming in. This one comes in with X2. And so it's just simple algebra now to put these two together, add and subtract them the right way, and you find out that you get this direct relationship between the ratios of the partonic Xs and the gauge boson rapidity. So what's happened with the modern PDFs is that we now have, instead of those single PDFs, we now have ensembles of PDFs. And we have ensembles because people try to incorporate now the experimental errors, and there's even some attempt to put in what you might call theory errors in the calculations, or theory uncertainties in the calculations, in fitting these PDFs. In the past, what we would do is basically there were three groups. There was ELK, and ELK is, they really put PDFs on the map in the sense that they compiled this, they made this set of ELK, Aitken, Hinshiff, Lane, and Quigg. They made a set of PDFs, and they produced a very thick, what eventually became a FISREV, FISMOD REV, or something like that. This was the argument for why we should build the SSE. Basically, once you have the PDFs and once you have leading order cross-sections, you can put them together and you can make an argument about what energy scale should the next collider be if we want to investigate the TEV scale. And so that's what they did. And that was really groundbreaking.
That's how we ended up with 40 TEVs.
So the way we ended up with right now 10 TEV is that the 40 TEV is the right answer. It is the right answer. It always will be the right answer. If anybody else tells you otherwise, punch them in the nose. It just isn't true. But if you're cheap and you want to build something in an old tunnel, if you don't want to spend the money on the tunnel, and if you have a certain limit on superconducting magnets, then you come up with 16 TeV. And then if things don't quite work so well and you want to be, they start blowing up magnets, and you want to be conservative, you lower that energy a little bit, so you go down to 10 TeV. The idea with the LHC has always been that if you have a huge amount of luminosity, you can compete with the SSC at 40 TeV with less luminosity.
So that's still true?
Doesn't matter.
Yes, we should have had it running by now.
A lot of it's going to depend upon...
It depends on the kinematics, right? It depends on...
It depends on the mass.
It depends on the low mass stuff.
Right.
It's
better
for
high mass stuff today. To me, the nightmare scenario is... so I think 5 years from now is a pretty critical point. So, and that's, even career-wise, we all have to be thinking 5 years from now. For a theorist, it's a lot, I'll think about something different. Okay, that's not such a big deal. But for people who are more project-driven, this is a big deal, because in 5 years, okay, we might find something running there. Don't discount that. I think that's a 33 1/3% probability. It's just such a huge change in energy. Right away, we're going to see some diejet resonance, and it's going to be great. Okay, we'll find something very early, and then you ask, well, do I really want to sit around and measure this stuff for 20 years? Well, maybe you do, maybe you don't. But that's the career decision you have to make. The other one, what I think is a 33 1/3% probability, is that you run for 5 years and you really haven't seen anything. And then there are these people saying, well, we'll see. We know the reason that 1 TeV was the right center mass energy and 40 TeV was the right collider, because we know that WW scattering has to get regularized, right? So if WW scattering starts to give probabilities that are greater than 1 or less than 0, something's wrong. So something has to happen in that energy scale. Okay, so there'll be people saying, but to reach that, you have to go to the huge luminosity. You go to huge luminosity, that means your detector starts slowly decaying or quickly decaying. Precision components become less precise. There was a model that Gordy Kane and CP Wan had for an SSC detector, which was a ball of iron with a muon detector outside, which might be what we end up with, because muons basically can penetrate that ball of iron. You don't need to worry about anything else.
That was also Cohen Lander's 1034 detector that ultimately informed CMS.
Okay. And there, you know, you're going to be on the edge of being able to say anything, I think. It's possible you could run for as long as you want, and you'll be systematics limited. You might see some excess in what you think is the WW mass above a TeV or so. But it'll be 2 sigma, 3 sigma. And then what do you do? And then there's a sweet spot that everybody hopes for, is that there's some physics out there which has cross-sections on the order of 100 femtobarns, and there's a whole bunch of new stuff being produced. And you know, 5 years from now, we'll be in the middle of that mess, and we'll be just trying to figure it all out, and then that's going to be fun. But, or I guess there's the extra possibility, which is something catastrophic happens in the running of the collider, but we don't want to think about that. So what we used to do, getting back on topic, is so we had the ELK did this work, but they never updated it. And then CTEC had their PDFs. They had one central PDF, which would change every few years as new data came out. So you go from CTEC 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. And then there's the MRST group in England. So the way, when people were trying to set a limit or they were trying to do a measurement, they would have to account for the fact that the PDFs might be wrong and they might be influencing what you're measuring or what you're setting a limit on. So the way you could set limits is that you would run your prediction with MRST and with CTEC, which would basically give you the same answer because they're both modern, in some sense, QCD with the same data going in, with some different treatment of the error bars, but really not so much difference. And then there was ELK, which was out of date, which gave you this huge error band. Right, a huge difference. And you said, oh, okay, you pat yourself on the back, I've accounted for this error, and oh, by the way, it's much smaller than any other error in the experiment, so I don't care about it.
It's dominating us right now.
Now it's dominating us, but it wasn't 5 years ago.
It depends. The counting experiment is dominating. It's not dominating all the little shape circles.
But I think I fairly characterize what we used to do.
Right.
Okay, so now what we do, we come up with these ensembles of PDFs which try to account for the error, so that if you sample from these PDFs, you do get a good representation of what one group would do if they accounted for errors and they did fits. Okay. And
can I ask you something about that, though?
No. I think, let me go through and see if I...
Well, let me just stop. Sorry, this is usually sort of a discussion, but when you do this, do you...
When you do this new approach?
we take all these different sigmas, all these different eigenvectors or whatever, and we usually add them up in quadrature and call that an uncertainty. Are we not overestimating, overcovering what our uncertainty would be? Like,
no, because they already find the so where do the 41, so you will find, if you get a CTEC 6 set of PDFs, you'll get 41.
Uh-huh.
What that represents is one central value, the best fit. And typically, there is an a priori form you use
mm-hmm.
for fitting. And, you know, you have a different one for gluon, a different one for up, different one for down, a different one for the C components. And then things like BB bar and CC bar all come from evolution of gluon.
Because that's one, two, there's four parameters there.
Yeah, but there's the way you get to 20 is that there's more than, and there are some additional constraints which bring it down to 20. Then you from these parameters you find orthogonal directions, and then you vary them by one sigma. So that's where the 40 comes from. Is that you have one central and 20, effectively 20 combinations of these parameters, which you then vary by one sigma to get your errors, and as long as you're really in a minimum,
it bothers me because if you look at some of the assumptions, it's like maximal gluon content, or you know, it just goes to the extreme edge of the threshold where you don't really think that it's.
It sounds like this is not what that is. Like,
yeah.
So supposed to be
plus one sigma. That's what Robin's question was.
Kind of, but I'm thinking more if we look at the individual eigenvectors, but yeah. Okay,
plus one sigma is defined as you have a minimum
mm-hmm.
and you fix all other 19 parameters, and what changes delta chi squared by one. So that's the standard definition. It's true that then once you do this, that this isn't the end of the story, that sometimes they weight some of the data differently.
Yeah.
So there is this bias built in, which gets trickled into the groups, and which do they really believe the error bars that the experiments gave them?
Also, are they trying to? They're trying to capture some of the theoretical uncertainties in these things.
This is a new thing that Fred Olmos and Dave Stoker are trying to incorporate. And what they find is that he just talked about this last week, that those errors are significant.
I mean,
so this will change.
Proper,
when
there's no well-defined
like
statistical treatment of those, right? I mean, you just make something up. You just assume that they're normal distributed and give some estimate.
They're making things up, but you know, a lot of people make things up, and you
are all made up anyway.
They have a method to their madness. So,
yeah.
But that's an entirely different topic. But a point to make is that to even do this whole exercise, you do need next leading order QCD. Leading order QCD gives you basically a crap fit from the beginning, and if you tried to vary these parameters, you'd get nothing that was stable. So that's a known issue. Is that really?
So we're using leading order in CDF.
No, you when you do the PDF reweighting, you use the next leading orders. But we'll talk about that mismatch.
Only recently.
Okay. And this, so good fits require next leading order, which we find will change things, observables like the rapidity of the boson.
All right.
Okay, and this isn't such an issue with the Tevatron, but it'll become more of an issue with the LHC.
You don't have the Q-square evolution in there explicitly. Is it done through the parameters evolving, or just DGLAT on some base function set? In other words,
when you
how do you do, if I just call the routine to give me the nominal PDF at some Q-square, is it evolving the parameters, or is it evolving a function from the nominal value of the parameter?
It's starting from this fit will give you a starting condition, and then you'll use there's many ways this happens, but if that way to calculate, you start with the boundary conditions fit in this method, and then you evolve them up, or someone, they might actually give you a grid and you just interpolate, and because that's faster than actually doing
so
the
there's a reference Q squared that's used for the fits.
Yes.
Q squared 0, what's that?
It's typically a Hera scale.
Yeah.
Two Jeb. Q squared to 2J squared.
But that input is influenced by the higher energy data that you have, right? The input is Q0 squared.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so what are event generators? Event generators are tools such as Pythia or Herwig And these are Monte Carlo models that use perturbative QCD as much as they can, both perturbative QCD in terms of fixed order, but also resumming, what's called resumming large logs, but all within perturbative QCD. Plus it has models for other aspects of the hadronic collision. And basically you start off with hadrons coming in and real stable particles coming out. So it's something that really is meant to describe what would be the input to the detector simulation. Which means you can't have bare quarks, because this, the CDF silicon vertex model doesn't know what to do if you give it a bare quark. Maybe it does, and it doesn't tell you. That's even scarier. But you need to turn things into real particles. And it uses PDFs in many more ways than they were originally intended. Okay, so it does use it for setting the kinematics at the high scale Q, which is sort of where the PDFs were originally intended to be used. But they also appear in what's called the backwards evolution initial state radiation algorithm. So in some sense, the initial state radiation algorithm takes the PDF and runs it backwards using so-called DQAP evolution to figure out what was the structure of the partons that came in. And this is what's responsible for giving transverse evolution to that gauge boson. So previously, you see that the longitudinal evolution that goes into DGLAP gives you the rapidity, but the transverse evolution, the PT of the gauge boson, comes from the initial state radiation. So you start off with the leading order calculation for ZPT just has a delta function at what I'll call QT squared equal to zero. And that's not what we observe. But because through this initial state radiation, muons are emitted as you evolve back using DGLAP, taking into account the PDFs. And this is what eventually gives you a PT spectrum to the Z boson, which instead of being a delta function at the origin, is something that looks like this. Also, the PDFs are used for the underlying event description, particularly in Pythia, because we try to describe the underlying event not just as a parameterization, but in terms of some semi-hard QCD scattering relatively low x. And this aspect is particularly important for the experiments. It's one of the main reasons that they tend to use Pythia more than Hurwig, because this model works fairly well. And it comes into many aspects of the experiment. This extra activity, so you ask yourself, where does that extra energy go when you have a hard collision? Where that extra energy goes is very important in setting where you should trigger on jets and where you have to do pre-scaling. What is the track occupancy that you're going to expect in your silicon? So you have to decide how far out your silicon has to be based on what you think the occupancy is going to be. It has some influence on the jet energy that you measure and how you relate that back to a parton. If you really want to relate to the QCD Lagrangian, which has that parton in it, you need to subtract out all the other stuff that isn't there. It's important for isolation. If you have a photon that really comes from a Higgs decay, if a charge track from this mechanism overlaps with it, you throw it away. Or the other way around, you can sometimes have an isolated pion produced, isolated pi zero, which goes to photon pairs. And if it doesn't have enough charge tracks around it, then it passes your limits, your cuts, and it becomes a Higgs, the gamma-gamma candidate. Not from the pi zero go to gamma-gamma, but you have two jets where you have a real photon and a pi zero that goes to a gamma-gamma.
So the backwards evolution of ISR is partly how we get the partly how PT of the Z, for example, is determined in the Monte Carlo domain?
Yes. There's two components to it. There is, it turns out that...
They know where I'm going with this.
Well, I don't know where you're going with this, but there is some point where if you were to run the perturbative calculation down, you would find that alpha strong would get too big. So then there is what we call some intrinsic KT. The idea is that if you have partons bound inside of the Fermi sphere, right, you have the hadron's basically something with a radius of a Fermi. Think of it as a box potential. If you throw a wave in there, right, it's going to have some just intrinsic KT because of the uncertainty principle. So there's some smearing of this. There's some parameterization, a tweakable parameter, a tunable parameter in Pythia, which really determines where this peak sits, but most
part
of this
64 or?
No, that's the
part
90s.
Part 90s.
What's the value of it?
Currently, it's rather large.
Few GE.
It's a few GE with a rather large tail.
So if I tweak the PARP 90, whatever, I would get a different PT for the Z.
You would get this peak would shift slightly.
I think the answer is no to your question.
But you guys measure this peak so well with such precision that we have to worry about that.
The PT of the Z is dominated by the radiation.
The soft gluon radiation, right. It just the shape is basically given by that perturbative evolution, but it's where this peak actually sits. It depends upon this other sphere.
The reason I'm bringing this up is you know that we don't get the PT of the Z boson right at all.
Well,
and I've heard it blamed on the underlying events, and now I'm confused.
I thought Pythia was doing really well with that.
No, right. I mean the Upton and Magrath plus Pythia.
But that's not intended to get that right. That I understand why you don't get that right. That you don't get right.
You're talking about the low PT. The low PT part of that is mired in the QCD muck.
It's funny. To get this right, you actually need to use standard Pythia with the matrix element correction built in. If you try to use the so-called Alpjed method with the matching, the showering scale, upper scale of the showering is slightly different, and you don't quite get it right.
But you'll get the N-jet distribution.
But you get the N-jet distribution right. We've actually made some changes. We're coming up with a model of this that helps to make this ameliorate the situation. But we've understood this. We've known about this problem.
I know you knew about.
But the issue is, we would say that for these measurements, you actually want to use a fixed order. You want to use an analytic calculation like Resbos. Because you use something like this to try to measure the mass of the W or the Z, or the width of the W or Z.
Well, certainly we would never make a precision measurement with Alpjen plus Pythia.
I see that it's meant for higher. It's meant for new physics searches, and it's meant for.
The problem is when we start getting the kinematic searches like Higgs in single top, where the signal is really small. You need to get it right because then you have any fluctuations will fake a signal. And yet you're using these, you have to use these vector, these matrix element plus Pythia type instructions but you're doing these multivariate analyses that are very shape dependent, and that includes PTs of, you know, if the PT of the W or the Z is off, that changes your jet threshold, for example, as you say.
It's hard to do all this stuff consistently. I liken it to this. I make a list of all the things I wish that my wife would do when I was at work.
Mm-hmm.
And they include, you know, keeping the floor clean, keeping the house clean, fixed up, you know, helping the kids with their... And then when I add these things all up, I say, Steve, you're an idiot. Why don't you just figure out how you can help?
Mm-hmm.
There's too many things
yeah.
you try to do with one tool.
Well,
and you can't make that one tool do that all those things.
It's just that for searches, because the signals are small, you're really sensitive to small variations in the kinematics, And so you can't really use it for searches. You can use it for sloppy measurements like top quark measurements.
That's the stage we are at, and you need to use more data-driven methods. Okay, so now the topic of my talk is, that's fair game. I like this sort of exchange. So why am I talking about modified leading Fourier PDFs? So what PDFs do we use with the Parton-Shower Monte Carlos? So the standard practice has been used to use leading order PDFs, most commonly the CTEC 5L, the CTEC 6L, and we use them in Pythia, we use them in Herwig, we use them in this other program called Sherpa. We use them when we put Alpjen and Magrath together with Pythia. We just use it universally. But this isn't an issue so much for the Tevatron, but at the LHC, I can show you examples where leading order PDFs basically get some very simple distributions wrong. Okay. And part of this is due to the influence of Hera data. The Hera data is all orders. Okay, if you can try to fit it with a leading order PDF, that's fine. But it's all orders, and it knows about next to leading order, and so you can't get something out of nothing in some cases. Also, at next to leading order, matrix elements will have enhancements in 1 over x and log of 1 minus x, which will sort of get compensated by the PDF. A leading order fit that doesn't know that this is sitting in the matrix element will, for example, enhance the gluon component to try to fit the data with a combination of leading order matrix elements and leading order PDFs. And when you go through this, you find that sometimes
your prediction sit outside what you thought were the next leading order error bands, meaning you took this ensemble of next leading order PDFs and you looked at what you thought was the range of possibilities for this observable, and you find when you use it with event generators with leading order PDFs or any of these other tools that you get something that goes outside what you thought were the errors. Okay. Also, what we tend to do is we actually generate our Monte Carlo when we need to use Monte Carlo. And there are many data-driven methods used in Run 2 in particular that tries to minimize the need for Monte Carlo. Okay. In my ideal world, Pythia would be in the garbage can. We would never have to use it. But reality is we still need to use it. But we need to use it in an intelligent way. And they try to use it in a way where they take the data and use that to normalize it in some region, and then sort of rely upon the rest of the prediction that Pythia gave you to extrapolate into different kinematic regions. So typically what is done is that you'll make a prediction for W plus jets, which is a background for top, using CTEC5L, because you want to get the underlying event model right. Okay. But then at the end you say, well, I need to account for the PDF uncertainties. So then we'll go back and we'll reweight, assuming that we had actually used these next leading order PDFs. Okay. Well, there's actually a mismatch there between what you used for the parton shower and what you used for reweighting the matrix element. Also something to bear in mind is that when you look at inclusive observables, so inclusive observables mean you sort of look like this, right? So I'll look at the PT of the Z boson, okay, but I'm not going to ask, is there a pi zero? Is there a pi on over there? Or are there three and only three jets in the event? When I look at inclusive or semi-inclusive observables, and I do that at next leading order, at leading order, I find in many cases that all I really have to do is take the leading order prediction and scale it up a little bit. Okay, that's sort of engineering, right? But it seems to work pretty well. Which might explain why, in many cases, you can actually use the data to normalize your Monte Carlo in some kinematic region and interpolate or extrapolate into a different region. Extrapolate into a different region.
Steve, I don't really understand that blue statement. What is being reweighted?
So what you do is you generate W plus jets, let's say. So you have a rate. The cross section is set by some combination of PDFs, right? For some process. And anything that happens with the showering, the hatization, all happens, something happens with probability one. So the cross section predictive doesn't change. Okay. But the PDFs not only set the cross section, they also have some impact on the kinematics of the gauge boson, let's say. Mm-hmm. Which at leading order is this. So you use CTEC5L, these leading order PDFs, for example, to predict this. And then you go back and you say, I want to account for the PDF uncertainty. So what you do is you take this and you subtract, so this is leading order. Okay. And you divide this out, and you imagine that you actually generated these using the central value of the next leading order. So the next leading order central of x1 and q squared, and after the next leading order central of x2 and q squared. And then you look at all the variations around this. Okay, and I'm saying there's a mismatch between this and this. And also, this was used for the evolution. The leading order PDF was used for the evolution, and the leading order PDF was used for the underlying event and for those three aspects.
So the reweighting is to...
You call it reweighting because you don't actually evaluate anything again. You take the event that you have, mm-hmm. which, let's say that event now has weight 1.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to say, well, now that event will have a slightly different weight. So that predicts a certain kinematics. Before that event had weight 1. And now it's going to have weight 1.2 for some events. And it's going to have a different event will have weight 0.8. So your rapidity distribution will get shifted around a little bit, for example. And then when you account for all of those, you then have an error bar on your. But ideally, you'd use the same PDFs all the way through. Okay. But you don't have the computation time
to rerun this 41 times. Okay. Or if they did, then all the bandwidth would be taken up. Yes.
If you have the NLO matrix elements, why wouldn't you use them, even if the leading order is pretty good?
Because next leading order P, okay, so there is no next leading order showering.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has really figured out how to do next leading order showering. And that requires like 1-3 splittings, for example. Everything now is done with 1-2 splittings.
Mm-hmm.
And there are regions of phase space which get become negative. And if you don't do the parton showering quite right, what's supposed to happen is that negative regions of probability get canceled by positive regions of probability, and everything is positive.
Mm-hmm.
But if the parton showering isn't done exactly right,
mm-hmm.
those two can get out of match. And that isn't worked out very well. Okay, so it's a pragmatic thing. I mean, doing this right would require maybe 5 years of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have data in September. So this is, but this always happens, right? The people who could do it can't do it because they're always involved in something. So when it becomes very important, then it'll eventually get done. Okay. And also, I talked a bit about this, the underlying event. The low X behavior of leading order PDFs are used in the models of the underlying event. And this can be very different between leading order and next leading order. And it's also used for calculating some cross sections, like in BFKL. So this is some motivation for trying to attack this problem differently, bearing in mind how you will use the PDFs. Rather, before you just imagine you're using the PDFs only for fixed order calculations. Now you're going to account for the fact that you're going to use them inside of event generators, for example. Okay, so this is the CTEC approach. The CTEC approach is that where Joey Houston's calling these LO star PDFs. So this is the behavior we would like to have. We want to get PDFs that make sense, but they behave as leading order as x goes to 0, because this means our underlying event model is sensible. We want them to be as close as possible to next leading order when x goes to 1. So we'll get things like the rapidity of the W plus boson, which I'll show you in a bit, right? You shouldn't have to be a rocket scientist to use these, so they should be relatively universal and produce reasonable results out of the box, because we can be guaranteed that people are never going to read the fine print and just go off and start using these as soon as you produce them.
Can I just ask, can you explain a little more why this second point there, why you want to be close to NLO as x goes to 1?
Mm. I'll show you a specific example in a few slides.
And is the idea that somehow there, the virtual sort of corrections are small, so that's pretty safe to do that even with a leading order matrix element or something?
Well, so here's the dirty secret.
Is there a general...
No, so let's think about the rapidity, particularly the W plus is the most sensitive to this. And you see this at the LHC because it's a proton-proton collider. And also most, since it's not a valence quark collider so much,
mm-hmm.
If you want to get UD bar, you have to rely upon getting something from the C, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more sensitive to the evolution in the C. And what you find is that so you do a next leading order calculation, you say, oh, look, there's a big shift in the rapidity of the W plus boson. That means you need to do next leading order calculations. If you dig deep into it, you find out that if you were to redo the next leading order calculation using leading order PDFs, you would also get the W rapidity wrong. And it turns out that the main effect is that you use next leading order PDFs.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, you'd like to use next leading order PDFs with a leading order matrix element. That seems to get the physics right. But there are other reasons that I showed you before that the whole using that next leading order PDF over the whole range becomes inconsistent.
So from your point of view, it's mainly an empirical thing? That,
yes.
Okay. For certain processes, but you're not my interest, frankly, is, you know, I'm thinking of this from, I've got some new physics model and I want to predict... You know, I want to and I care about large X because it's high PT physics. So, you know, I want to know, should I believe that these LO star cross sections are going to give me a better result than leading order cross PDFs?
Yeah, yes. And if your observable is something like you produce a color signal and you're interested in one of these observables, which is related to the hard matrix element, then in particular that you'll see a shift that will depend on the PDFs and not on any difficult higher order calculation.
Okay, and we want these PDFs to be reasonable when using the parton shower, to give a similar underlying event as we fit now, something so that PDF reweighting makes sense. We want them to describe the underlying event at the Tevatron with a tune similar to what we use already for convenience and extrapolate to a reasonable underlying event at the LHC. Okay. You could change any number of these, but this is our approach because it's very pragmatic. Okay. So this is particularly what I'm talking about. And
so, just coming back to the equation, what is that phrase? So PDF on the previous page.
Okay, so the PDF, yeah.
So PDF reweighting makes sense.
So that you don't have this mismatch, for example, between weeding order and exceeding order. But the whole idea of reweighting, again, since I don't think I described it well before, is that you would like to take some aspect of your Monte Carlo, of your prediction, and you want to see how would it change if you twiddled some parameter. It's too time consuming to actually go through with that parameter twiddle, and sometimes you don't actually have to do that. You can take the ensemble of events that you already have, and you can imagine that you Monte Carloed it again. And the ratio of PDFs is now just a new factor. How did you get, you know how you get unweighted events as it is? You had a distribution of weights that looked like this, and what you did is you found the max. This is typically how you do it, right? So this is some distribution of probabilities, or you know, if you take a cross-section, d sigma dx, and x goes from 0 to 1, and you divide by the total cross-section, this is a probability. You have something like this, and typically you find the max, and then what you do is you select any other point that comes along, and then you throw a random number, and you say, is this predicted cross-section at that point times bigger than this max times a random number? If it is, then you keep it, otherwise you throw it away. And this ends up, you can prove to yourself, calculating the area under here, which is the total probability. So you already did an unweighting to get to this point. Mm-hmm. Reweighting means we can correct for the fact that we use a different PDF by taking uniformly evented weights and then giving them this giving them a new weight from away from unity and going through this process again. Then we get to recycle the events that we already fully simulated through the CDF or D0 detector simulation. Because we didn't change anything about how these particles changed into 30 pi pluses and 1 k long and 50 k shorts and all this other stuff. All we did is we changed how often that happened, and we did it in a consistent way.
Okay, so now can we define reweighting makes sense? I mean, in what sense did it not make sense?
Well, it didn't make sense because you didn't actually do this. You ignored the fact that you used leading order PDF here, and you treated it from the start as though you used the central next leading order PDF to calculate. So the assumption being that had you calculated this using next leading order PDF for the central value, you would have gotten the same result, and that actually isn't true. But it hasn't been an issue yet, but it will become an issue. Okay. Good questions. So what you would find is if you just used leading order, CTEC 6L1, and because of the fact that it's a PP collider. So what's different about the Tevatron? Why should you never turn off the Tevatron? Okay, it's a PP bar collider, right? You're producing a W plus. How do you do it? You get a U quark, a valence U quark out of here, and you get a valence D bar quark here, and you collide them, and you get a W plus. Okay, from the valence quarks, right, where most of the energy and momentum is inside of the proton at high x. Now we're at a PP collider. Okay, and to get that D bar, okay, so here comes the U valence quark, maybe, but you got to get that that D from some evolution, right? Here's a D bar. Okay, and so you might know that, but the distribution of gluons tends to be that where they stack up in x in partonic x tends to be small, whereas quarks are not so small. So now you get this mismatch, and you can sort of see in your head that what that means is that you tend to throw the W plus or W minus, the W plus in a forward direction. Okay? But at next leading order, which we think we believe, you find out that the distribution is much flatter. Okay? And if you use these modified PDFs with the leading order matrix element, you get something that looks like this, which all it does, it looks just like this, but there's a K factor. There's a difference in normalization between this and this, but typically experiments don't rely upon Pythia to tell them what the event rate is. They use something else in the data, but they rely on Pythia to tell them what event shapes look like, which is the right thing. Because the event shapes are usually something that's all orders or very high orders, and that Pythia is meant to get right. And this is just showing you some of the differences. If you look at almost impossible to see, but if you look at the leading order PDF and the next leading order PDF with the error band, and you look at what's going on for the up quark distribution, okay, you see that the leading order tends to be a little bit lower here and a little bit higher here. And when you look at it more in terms of differences, you find out that there's a big difference, particularly at large X here, particularly because there are no log 1x over terms in the leading order matrix element. It doesn't know about these, so it changes the up, and again, the data is the data. It's all orders. So it moves the PDF to try to fit these. Okay. And now we look at the gluon, and here there's much bigger differences. Like I told you before, there is this missing log of 1 over x term in the leading order matrix elements, so the gluon PDF tends to blow up here.
I just ask about those small and large x behavior things. So you're saying they're not there in the leading order matrix element, but why are they there in the leading order PDFs?
Because they're fitting the same data.
But I mean, isn't it? So these are not singularities. They're supposed to, if I did a full NLO calculation, it's not the case that these terms are going to cancel between the PDFs and the matrix elements.
Yeah, some of the singularity gets swept in the next single order calculation. Some of the singularity gets swept or subtracted out of the definition of the PDF.
I mean, there's a physical singularity at small x and large x. They remain in the physical matrix element.
Well, they're logarithmic, but they're so they're under control, but they're big.
Okay.
Okay.
So there are these long terms, and they generally get contributions from the PDFs and the matrix elements, but at leading order, the matrix element doesn't have them. Share of it.
So the PDF has got to go up because it has to fit the same data.
Okay.
And then this is just, you know, an advertisement for the type of tunes that are done by Rick Field. He's now doing tunes with CTEC 6L. He used to do them with CTEC 5L, which was the old set. And this is just, you know, to show you there's a whole bunch of different tunes that are all consistent with Tevatron data, which give different extrapolations to the LHC, so this is an issue. The fact that you get a whole wide range of predictions for the LHC tells me that there's enough bells and knobs in the model you have that you can fit the LHC data once we get it. I'm not so concerned that they give different answers because the model isn't meant to be predictive. It's a model. It's not meant to extrapolate to such a wide range. It's something you have to measure in situ, but once we're there, we'll be able to fit something that makes sense.
So these quantities here are some kind of underlying event numbers, or
so this is
the yellow, the ones that you're predicting.
So if you take this is becoming more of a course. I'm sorry. if you just look at if you use just the simple 2-to-2 matrix elements for QCD cross sections, okay. And so it's very simple. They just become d sigma, dpt. They all go with something like 1 over pt to the 4th. Okay. And you use that with the leading order PDFs, and you look at the predicted cross-section as a function of pt, the total cross-section. Okay. So here's your, about 300 and some, 300 plus. So that's the total hadronic cross-section, right? You find at some point it becomes larger than that. Okay, and our interpretation of this is that actually means that you didn't just have one scatter, you had more than one scatter. So these are inclusive predictions. So if you had an event
that had three scatters in it, you would count it three times in this plot. Which is why we have a model of the underlying event, which is something like this, where you have the height, you have some scattering like this, but then on top of it, back here with the remnant, you have some other lower PT collision, and then with the rest of the remnant, you have some other semi-hard QCD prediction with lower PTs. I should drop this a little so I know higher PTs.
They call it triple parton scattering?
No, that's not triple parton scattering. That's one event that has three semi-hard scatterings in it. That's the that is the underlying event model, which seems to work so well inside of 50. This cutoff here is simply this the point where you match the total occlusive cross section. So it's a phenomenological parameter which is related to then the multiplicity of these events. And then this is that total cross section for multiple parton interactions that I was talking about here. Okay. The way we actually do this fit, which is a little bit inspired, I think, is that we take next leading order calculations used with MCFM and we treat them like data. Because we know these are the distributions we want to get right. And then we tweak the error bars inside of the fitting procedure so that they get high weights. But then we throw it in along with the other CTEC 6 data sets. And we use a variety of processes, the W and Z and Higgs rapidity distributions, the TT bar production rate, and the BB bar production rate, to be the processes that we fit to try to get the sort of behavior we want. We have various choices going into this procedure. We can use one loop or two loop alpha strong. I'll come back to this. We either have a fixed momentum sum rule or not, which means if you take all the energy momentum in the partons and you add them up, do they equal the energy momentum in the proton or not? Just think about that for a second. We have different, what I'm trying to show you is we don't know what to do yet, and we're trying a whole bunch of different things to try to get something that works reasonably. We have some K factors that we allow to float, and we also experiment with what happens if you change the scale of the hard scattering, because these PDFs are, after all, evaluated at a certain Q squared, and it could be that if you pick the right Q squared that you could get good low X behavior, preferred low X behavior, and preferred high X behavior.
Well, do they violate the momentum sum rule?
Well, if you think about it, since you're trying to force leading order and next leading order evolution from next leading order evolution, you got to break something.
Yeah.
So we're
dealing with a 1 TeV scale. We have 14 TeV or whatever, so it's probably not such a bad problem.
So I'll show you how much that is, how much momentum, energy momentum sum rule is violated, and what it means.
Okay.
So we're almost done, so don't worry. Okay. So just some observations. The pseudo data has conflicts with the global data, but that's part of the original problem. We want to try to get these distributions right. We find that if we don't fix alpha strong to be 0.118 at the z-pole, that we can get a better fit. And we find out we do much better if we allow the momentum sum rule to be free. We find that you only need to violate the momentum sum rule at 5%.
How much does alpha S change?
Alpha S changes to about 0.124, but that's not unlike the alpha strong you get from jet shapes at LEP. And it actually it's not like that alpha strong is used anywhere else. It's really just used in the PDFs, and it's sort of setting the lambda QCD, which somehow sets the scale of parton showering.
Yeah.
Okay. So what does this mean? So what we're saying is that to get make a sensible model, make sensible PDFs like this, that you have to account for all the energy momentum inside of the proton, but you allow a little bit extra to go into the gluon. It's as if as though you give a K factor to gluon-induced processes. Mm-hmm. So it's not an unreasonable thing. And part of my job in this project is to go through every physical observable I can find and see if this does anything horrible. So I actually, run this through Pythia and see what happens. Okay. So here again, this is, again, coming back to the W plus rapidity, which is really an important one here.
this is basically what we get with these sets, which something that looks much like the next leading order. Depending upon the binning, this can be quite different. This doesn't look like such a big effect here. But when I bin it, I get something that's really spiked up here. And there's a big change going from the leading order PDF to either the modified next leading order PDF or the next leading order PDF. So they seem to make sense here. This is the rapidity of the Higgs. Again, we find something that looks like the next leading order or next to next leading order answer, but just scaled up. This is the alpha strong we get when we let it to float. But again, all that sets is the lambda QCD that goes into the parton showering algorithm.
So are we supposed to look at this plot and say that a K factor for the NO, for the LO star one, will work better than a K factor for the LO?
Well, so first of all, the K factor is smaller. But also the shape, this shape is much more like this than this shape is like this. This shape is different, and it has a bigger K factor. This shape is about right, and it has a lesser K factor.
You understand? Yeah.
Okay.
So what's the TT normalization equal 0.76 referring to? That's top anti-top cross section or something?
Right. We find that we need a K factor for TT bar. That's that actually brings it down.
Is that agreeing with some sort of more theoretical approach?
No, this is pure phenomenology, right? If you try to make all these data sets be consistent, we find that you have to let the TT bar normalization go up. But again, at leading order, you don't expect to get the normal. We already know that we know there's something in that this is a counterexample where there's something in the next leading order calculation beyond the PDFs that increases the cross section.
Decreases. Right.
Well, actually decreases, you're right. Because we have to decrease the leading order result. We still have too much glue. That's right.
Yeah.
Do the English guys also get the momentum sum and the alpha S?
So all they've done is they've played with, I'm going to go to this, the MRST group has also done this, and all they do is they relax the momentum sum rule. And they find they need 14% more, which is different than our 5%, but we still need to double check why they get a different answer than we do. What this means is, okay, here you have leading order PDF, leading order matrix element for Drevi-Yan production. Here you have leading order PDF, leading order matrix element. And you see that even as a function of rapidity, it's way off. Here you have the next leading order PDF with the leading order matrix element. That, again, this is what I was saying before, that it basically has the right shape, but the normalization is off. And this is their LOP star with their leading order matrix element. So actually, I think we're doing better in terms of this shape because ours is flatter and it has a closer K factor. But theirs is already available, so people will start using it. This is available in a tool that people can use. So that's why we got into it, that we want to do it our own way and see if it's consistent.
The two effects work in the same direction, so if you fix alpha S and just relax the momentum sum rule, do you also get larger?
Yes, we do. Okay, and then this is just so I'll go through, you don't need to see this, but we basically get the behavior we want where we fit CTEC 6L at low X and we fit CTEC 6L1 at high X for the gluon. And you can see that here we focus on small X and you see really the big difference between the CTEC and next leading order and the CTEC leading order. And I'll take 2 minutes to talk about the error PDS, then K factors, and then finish up.
I have one question.
Sure.
Before, I mean, there's, of course, all this, one of the constraints on the PDFs is the jet cross section has to come out right?
Yes.
And so I always ask this question without really getting an answer. Is it still possible that there could be some kind of anomalous jet cross-section given other constraints? I suppose you used all your other constraints, but not the jet cross-section constraint. Could you then have a situation where you would conclude that you were getting an excess of jets, of contact interaction or whatever?
The jet cross-section is not the most constraining in terms of the rate, but in terms of the rapidity dependence.
Yes.
And so that is actually very constrained on the PDFs. So I don't think there's much wiggle room at the tetratron for that. But
But what I'm saying, I mean, could we be fooling ourselves, and could there really be an anomalous contact interaction if you did use the Tevatron data on jets to constrain your PBS?
Did you fit away a contact? Suppose the real world has a contact interaction that contributes to the two jet cross section, and is it possible that we fit it away by fiddling with the PDFs? I think that's the question.
I believe no. And the reason I believe no is because you don't just look at inclusive jet production, but you look at this funny chi angle, which is something in the rest frame of the jets, which is supposed to, you know, that chi would be related to like 1 over sine theta. So, you know, Rutherford scatter would be like 1 over sine theta to the fourth or something. That shape distribution is most constraining to the contact interactions like KPDO. Though, to be fair, we really only use one model of contact interactions. We don't use all possible combinations. We basically use the contact interaction that's an elk, left-handed.
So you're saying that there are details of the distributions that do not allow for particular forms of the contact
interaction.
That's
correct, yes.
I thought
no matter what you do with the PDFs.
That is correct.
I thought the big thing is you're using a kind of an angular. You look at the interference term between the contact interaction and the actual QCD process, and it has a different angular shape, right? And you're not so sensitive to the normalization of the PDF because it's some angular variable ultimately. I thought that was the...
Yeah, but now you're getting me worried that if it's actually an interference, that means that it would depend upon the rate.
Well, it's just matrix element. I mean, the point is that the kinematics of, you know, the angular distribution is very different than the pure QCD production.
Yes.
And so you don't really use the rate. It's not counting an excess number of jets. The strongest constraints on the contact interactions come from these angular things, and it's harder to absorb that into it.
It's harder. So my question is it just simply impossible?
I think your statement was most correct, that for a range of models, that it is highly disfavored.
Okay.
One of the reasons for doing something that has something like next leading order in it is we'd like to have these error PDFs, like I said before. And again, it's the error PDFs imply a level of precision that is next leading order. You can't get anything sensible from leading order. And for 3 years, I complained to CTEC, not being a member yet, why won't you give us leading order PDFs? And finally, I know why. It's because it doesn't give a result that they want to make public. This will demonstrate for you the importance of these PDF uncertainties. This is inclusive jet cross-section data in RON 2, and in the yellow you see the systematic uncertainties coming from the experiment, and the red here is the PDF uncertainty. And unless you accounted for this, you would clearly be claiming that there was some problem. And as you go to higher and higher rapidity, well, this is actually nice that the experimental errors are becoming smaller. But these high rapidity bins are particularly important for when this is then used for constraining PDFs. It's particularly important. And also to have this segmentation, not just to look in one region.
It's almost as if there's a hand pushing up the data point there.
Yeah. Which
is your pointer on the...
Oh, that's... Yeah.
Yes, right. So are you going to show us this angular variable that you just referred to?
No, I have to look it up. It wasn't. That's an off-topic. I mean, it's
okay.
Germane, but I would have to look it up.
I'd like to see the same kind of plot for that.
And then just show you why this is important for the LHC as well is that so once you have these 41 PDFs, you tend to find the PDFs which give you the largest deviation, and so this is showing you. What are these? These are ratios of jet cross-sections relative to using the central PDF in different rapidity ranges. And you see how for very high PTs of jet production at the LHC that you can easily have a factor of 2 difference just coming from PDF variations. So this is something that we need to incorporate in our programs.
So if I look at that...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, should I take any lesson from the fact that only a couple of these BDFs give me these big deviations, and most of them are much smaller? Is that, how am I supposed to interpret that?
You should plot the whole ensemble, but people are lazy. This should show, demonstrate
should
to
I,
you.
Should I summarize, is there some probabilistic sense in which these,
right,
these outliers are much less probable because there's only whatever two of them, and there are 39 of them that are clustered in this little region?
Well, each one is, you know, as one signal as likely.
So
they're not all plotted.
Yes, I am, well, they're all equally likely. So
but they haven't all been plotted here. They should all be plotted. So the density here in the middle is underrepresented. But also this demonstrates that there are certain data sets,
right,
which pick out certain directions. And that's where these outliers come from.
Mm-hmm.
So certain measurements over certain kinematic regions could bring these ones down. That's, I mean, you can't get that from this plot, but that's true. That's where these outliers come from. If you go back and look at what is the data that constrains this, it's going to be something like high X glue at temperature.
So some of these are gotten by throwing out some data or something that...
No.
What do you mean by
just
data?
Just a one sigma error in that particular data.
And then
I see, and then
extrapolated.
I see. Some errors are... Okay, some one sigma errors are more...
All
more
errors are
smooth,
equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yeah.
And this does include, again, this Angular variable. So
no, not this.
No, but I mean,
this is just looking at
the Markov distribution functions are all constrained to give you the right Angular, this extra Angular variable in the jet process.
No, it's an entirely independent analysis.
Oh, but I thought you were putting in all data to get your PDFs.
No. But there's a subset of this data which is used at the temperature. There's a subset of this data which is used for that particular analysis. So you take all the jets and basically boost them back to their rest frame and then look at this funny Angular distribution.
Okay, but that data is not used in getting these PDFs from what you just said. Is that right?
That particular fit is not sensitive to the PDFs. So it does not, looking at that Angular distribution doesn't constrain your PDFs.
Which you can feed backwards to say
that there's not very much PDF dependence on that particular.
Right.
But again, I only know that's true for a particular model of contact interaction that we've used. So I don't want to say a statement that's overly that's overly conservative. I don't want to say something that could be wrong. So
actually, if can I just come back to my question again? Sorry, but
yeah,
but
sure.
If those large outliers there correspond to just the some one sigma deviation in one particular part of the data set, then it seems to me the right statistical interpretation is you should take the biggest. It's dominating the error. That's telling me that that's completely dominating the error for this particular process. And I should interpret the biggest deviation as sort of the one sigma error. Isn't that right? I mean, the fact that there are many other things that don't change the answer is irrelevant, right? If you're just telling me one particular data set, I do a one sigma deviation on it, and I get that top curve, then it seems to me that that's an estimate of the one sigma error. No?
I don't have any problems with your interpretation. The reason this happens is because this is not that big of a... This doesn't stand out as any different at the Tevatron. And it's simply because we have a different PDF mix, a different process mix, and a different energy scale at the LHC that this is now getting enhanced. So there's some truth to what you say. Now, when we're...
Yeah, well,
in situ,
if you think, let me give you, just repeat what Mark just said. I mean, if you have a two-parameter space, you know, the way you get the one sigma errors is you draw some ellipse,
right,
and you look for the biggest asymptote,
right?
And that's what Mark is saying.
Right.
I think,
but
in
what you will do
language,
in practice, I mean, this is what we'll do for the first few years, but once we start measuring jets, we'll do PDF fitting at the LHC.
Oh, sure.
And then we'll know. But I think you're right. I think
these
that's
are only available for next to leading order PDFs, these ensembles.
Right, but we're working on, we know this is important. This is one of the motivations for us going down this path.
It's also interesting now just for predictions of new physics. I mean, you know, if you're predicting some rate for some new physics, I'd like to know if my prediction is off by a factor of two or what, right? So, okay.
We don't quite know how to treat this yet because...
It is.
Yeah. That's probably true.
I mean, one idea we have is that we could take each of the ensemble that we have now and use that and weight the pseudodata differently at the LHC and redo our fit, and then we'll get a whole bunch of different PDF fits. But it won't be exactly the same procedure that you used before, where you found these orthogonal directions. So we're going to try that, but we're not quite sure how we should try to produce these error PDFs for the modified PDFs, but we're going to do that. That's one of our ideas. Okay. And then this is just sort of justifying my comment on k-factors that I made before. This table is too busy, but if you go back through my slides, which I'll give you, this will show you that basically k-factors between the Tevatron and the LHC aren't so different. And, well, okay, this is what it is. Here we take different processes. Here we take different scales. Mu naught is a central scale, so let's say for W production you use a W mass, and the variation, the upper variation would be, you know, 2MW. For TT bar production you might use the top mass or 2 times the top mass. This is showing you the different K factors you get at the Tevatron, depending on whether you use that low value or that high value. And then this is the next leading order K factor, which using just that smaller value. And you see that event rates, if you're interested in event rates, you know, the K factors you get here relative to the K factors you get here aren't so different. Okay, so I'm just going to put it all together. The LHC will be a very exciting thing. We're all excited. We got excited, and then we lost our excitement, and then we're waiting for our excitement to come back up again. You know, the first thing we're going to do before we find new physics is make sure we understand the old physics, and to get that old, because we need to get that old physics right. In that process, we'll need new phenomenological tools to confront the data at the LHC. PDFs impact many aspects of modeling high-energy collisions. We at CTEC and also the other group, MRST, are trying to address some of the inconsistencies. We think we're looking more globally at how PDFs are used, and we'll have public results available soon, including modified error PDFs. I didn't have that, but I wanted to give you an idea of what are the sort of things that I'm working on these days. And thank you for all the questions. It was a good talk. I mean, that was a good exchange. Good on you. Good on you. So we can go to your office and I'll find, I know it's V0, but I think the best measurement of that, just because they have a better, the larger rapidity range. Because I find it's like, oh, CDF does better.
Yeah, good to your rapidity range.
So I have one final question. Why is the momentum symbol ignored in all this? And why was that the right thing to relax?
It was just a brainstorm idea. It just came up. No, I don't know.
I mean, there are other things I could have relaxed, right?
Well, what else could you have? Okay,
I could have, forced myself to obey the momentum sum rule, and that would have forced bigger errors on me.
So then you end up with a result that doesn't fit any of the data well. Because you're really trying to force leading order evolution at one place and next leading order evolution in another place. And if you try to use next leading order, and we're using next leading order evolution. So if you, unless you change the DGLAP evolution so that it interpolated between those two regions, that's an idea. You could change the DGLAP evolution to interpolate between those two regions.
Which two regions are you referring to?
Between next leading order and leading order.
Okay, yeah.
You know, maybe find the region where they cross. But what that does to perturbative QCD, I haven't actually explored the consequences of that.
But there's no theoretical motivation for this, right?
For what we do?
Yeah.
No.
No, for relaxing the momentum.
No.
Just shot in the dark. And
yeah.
It's worrisome. I think it's worrisome.
Right. But what's surprising is that...
We just have the beam energy wrong?
Most of that energy momentum goes into something you can't see.
I mean,
it goes down the beam.
You don't just have virtual corrections,
right.
You have real correction.
Right.
So, you of course, all the energy you added up is, energy is conserved, but
yeah.
You start
or
getting... That's right. I mean,
Yeah, most of the energy seems to go down the beam pipe.
Right.
So I mean, you know, like one, the reason I personally I was interested because, for example, we're doing something that involves very high PT production at LHC, where you're starting to really become limited kinematically limited, right? Or the PDFs are really dropping off. It's done, and this one happens to be gluon PDF. So it'd be great if there was a more. I know that, you know, sort of everything is uncertain. It's sort of a factor of two level, but some things might be even a lot worse. And it'd be nice to know, you know, if there was just an ensemble of PDFs. You don't have to be a wise, you know, a wise person with lots of experience or something in PDFs. You just have an ensemble and you run it and you just see, get an idea of how uncertain.
Well, that's what they're providing.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm just saying. I think it's for new physics. It's also very interesting because some, you know, if you want to know, for example, what is the high PT reach for the LHC, this is what's setting the limits, right? Is how big are your PDFs at large X?
And another thing we'll provide is just a table for what we found useful is that if you just look at gluon, if you look at luminosities, what you really want to set your limit is you'd like to know what is the glu luminosity,
right,
at a certain Q squared,
right.
Right, so that's just a convolution of two PDFs, and it's much easier to just read off that from that table what you want to know instead of getting these individual PDFs. You have a question? Nope, you're just smiling. You're just happy.
So,
I heard a theory talk, I understood.
I was going to tell you at several points when you were making some comments that this talk is going to go online, but I guess it's too late now.
No, that's okay. No, parts of it have been shown before
recording.
I didn't say
what happened to the Elk guys? They just moved on to other things that they didn't want to keep this up, or they just
they got lazy.
They got lazy.
I think that's the answer. Yes.
Got tenure. No. No, they were never in it for that business. They were. I mean, it's a serious business, right? It's not something you can just do as part time.
But CTEC wasn't around yet, and that's why CTEC
didn't
do this.
So Duke and Owens were doing their own fits at that time, right?
Right.
And Morphin was involved in that somewhat. Mm-hmm. And I think around that time they asked for this is an NSF grant, they asked for some money.
Mm-hmm. This is a super collider physics paper that came out, right?
Super collider physics.
Right.
Yeah, they released modern physics. We're actually trying to remake something like that within CTEC, but on the web. Because we find we typically get asked... the same questions again and again,
right.
And you know, what is this event rate going to be? What is this event rate going to be? And having it tabulated somewhere.
Yeah, that would be very useful. I mean, even if the exact thing that you want is not on there, you can try to reproduce it or look at things that are similar. That would be very useful.
But what we're finding is that we need a full-time graduate student or someone who would actually put this together in a useful way on the web. There's a lot of things you could do, but it's not good use of our time to.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Do you guys get summer students or grad students or anyone that help? Does Joey get people?
Well, so the people at universities all have students. You can see continuing problem. What's that?
PDG has this fancy live version of PDG. They have software experts.
Right.
Doing.
PDG has not been the most friendliest group to interact with.
It seems like a natural thing for PDG to get involved with.
It does, but I'll just give you an example. I asked a certain prominent physicist at Berkeley for the database for all of their tile data. Or yes, because what we find is there's inconsistencies between what's in this program called EVTGen, which was developed at Babar, which is now sort of the modern tool for decaying B mesons. So we wanted to get the B, we didn't look at tau data, we wanted to get the B data from PDG to try to make sense of this and try to get the error bars. And I was told that they were changing their system, that it was in a database that predated SQL, and that they basically get back to us in 2 years. Some
with some results, and you know, I was even refused just to be able to look at it. I was told that it would blind me. So, and people continually argue about the error bars and the choices that PDG makes. People within the experimental community.
Or was John just suggesting that they do some of their stuff because they have software?
They have people who have
professionals
putting
that
things
well,
on the web that help.
Durham actually does this better. They have Mike Wally, who's a full-time person, and you know, some of these PDF bots I showed are generated in real time. You go to the IEEE Durham PDF base, and you say, I want to look at the CTEC 6 whatever for the gluon over this X range and this Q squared. And it'll generate, it actually makes a PAW macro.
Very useful. Yeah.
It makes a PAW macro, gives you a Git file. And then you can download the macro, which only three of us in the community can use because everyone uses root. And
right.
So, you know, they do tend to keep up to date with us. You know, Joey is Joey is very active with this, and he's now an adjunct at Durham, which helps. But I have the continual problem that I, being in the computing division, right? If I were to find the perfect person to work with me, then I could make a case and try to get something like a postdoc for a person to work with me. But I'm competing with people who would really rather have theory postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to advertise something. You can't really promise anything until you actually have a candidate. So I've been actually a little bit frustrated by this, and trying to find ways around the system. But given the crisis, the funding issues at the Fermilab, it's not very promising.
Right.
Anyways, but there are certain things. There's certain money that's set aside that should and could be spent that just isn't used.
Did any LPC money go to any of this stuff?
Well, yeah, there's a CD CMS postdoc that could be used for this.
I would suggest we continue this discussion over coffee.
But, you know, it'd have to be somebody weird like me, right?
Right. Yeah.
Thank you for saving me with the...